TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. This is a TUC Radio archive recording in memory of Aaron Swartz. His suicide on January 11, 2013, points to unresolved issues of internet freedom and judicial misconduct that concern us today. Remember the upcoming February 2015 FCC vote on net neutrality and the needed reform of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, under which Aaron was prosecuted. Also, remember the demand to hold responsible United States Attorney from Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz. She requested 50 years in prison for Aaron Swartz. Here's Film on Radio in honor of Aaron Swartz.
A co-founder of the social news and entertainment website Reddit has been found dead.
He certainly was a prodigy, although he never kind of thought of himself like that.
He was totally unexcited about starting businesses and making money.
There's a profound sense of loss tonight in Highland Park, Aaron Swartz's hometown, as loved ones say goodbye to one of the internet's brightest lights.
Open access and computer activists are mourning his loss.
An astonishing intellect. You talk to people who knew him.
He was killed by the government, and MIT betrayed all of its basic principles.
They wanted to make an example out of him, okay?
Governments have an insatiable desire to control.
He was potentially facing 35 years in prison and a $1 million fine.
Raising questions of prosecutorial zeal and I would say even misconduct.
That's the opening of the movie, The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz, released in June 2014. The director, Brian Knappenberger, said about the film, "This is the story of programming prodigy and information activist Aaron Swartz, from his help in development of the basic internet protocol RSS, to his co-founding of Reddit. His fingerprints are all over the internet. But it was his groundbreaking work in social justice and political organizing, combined with his aggressive approach to information access, that ensnared him in a 2-year legal battle with the federal government. It was a battle that ended with the taking of his own life at the age of 26. Aaron's story touched a nerve with people far beyond the online communities in which he was a celebrity. This film is a personal story about what we lose when we are tone-deaf about technology and its relationship to our civil liberties." End of quote. As a child, Aaron was already writing code for a Star Wars trivia quiz that he invented. He was only 12 years young when he won the Ars Digita competition for a web encyclopedia site called The Info. In concept and function, The Info preceded the launch of Wikipedia by 3 years. Aaron followed through on his idea, even though his teacher told him that allowing the public to write and edit an encyclopedia was really stupid. When at age 13, Aaron participated in the discussion group on developing the concept and architecture of the Creative Commons. Everybody valued his contributions, and nobody knew how young he was until they finally met him in person.
One of the things he was most passionate about was copyright, especially in those early days.
Copyright has always been something of a burden on the publishing industry and on readers. What Aaron's generation experienced was the collision between this antique copyright system and this amazing new thing we were trying to build, the internet and the web. These things collided.
He then met Harvard Law professor Lawrence Lessig, who was then challenging copyright law in the Supreme Court. A young Aaron Swartz flew to Washington to listen to the Supreme Court hearings. Lessig was also moving forward with a new way to define copyright on the internet. It was called Creative Commons.
So the simple idea of Creative Commons is to give people, creators, a simple way to mark their creativity with the freedoms they intended to carry. So if copyright is all about all rights reserved, then this is a kind of some rights reserved model. And Aaron's role was the computer part. Like, how do you architect the licenses so they would be simple and understandable and expressed in a way that machines could process it?
Come to our website here, and you go to Choose License. It gives you this list of options, explains what it means, and you fill out three simple questions. Do you want to require attribution? Do you want to allow commercial uses of your work? Do you want to allow modifications of your work?
I was floored, just completely flabbergasted, that these adults regarded him as an adult.
Though critics have said it does little to ensure artists get paid for their work, the success of Creative Commons has been enormous. Currently on the website Flickr alone, over 200 million people use some form of Creative Commons license.
He contributed through his technical abilities, and yet it was not simply a technical matter to him.
Aaron often wrote candidly in his personal blog.
Except for education and entertainment, I'm not going to waste my time on things that won't have an impact. I want to make the world a better place.
Schwartz was inspired by one of the visionaries he had met as a child, the man who had invented the World Wide Web, Tim Berners-Lee. In the 1990s, Berners-Lee was arguably sitting on one of the most lucrative inventions of the 20th century. But instead of profiting from the invention of the World Wide Web, he gave it away for free. It is the only reason the World Wide Web exists today.
You know, you had to have the critical mass for this thing was the entire planet. So it's not going to work unless the whole planet can get on board.
Schwartz threw his energy into a string of new projects involving access to public information, including an accountability website called watchdog.net and a project called the Open Library.
I love libraries. You know, I'm the kind of person who goes to a new city and immediately seeks out the library. But that's the dream of Open Library, is building this website where both you can leap from book to book, from person to author, from subject to idea, go through this vast tree of knowledge that's been embedded and lost in big physical libraries that's hard to find, that's not very well accessible online, is really important because books are our cultural legacy. You know, books are the place people go to write things down, and to have all that swallowed up by one corporation is kind of scary.
How can you bring public access to the public domain?
I had been trying to get access to federal court records in the United States. What I discovered was a puzzling system called PACER, which stands for Public Access to Court Electronic Records. I started Googling, and that's when I ran across Carl Malamud.
PACER is just this incredible abomination of government service. It's 10 cents a page. It's this most brain-dead code you've ever seen. You can't search it. You can't bookmark anything. You got to have a credit card. And these are public records. It's you know, U.S. district courts are very important. It's where a lot of our seminal litigation starts, you know, civil rights cases, patent cases, all sorts of stuff. And journalists and students and citizens and lawyers all need access to PACER, and it fights them every step of the way. It's a poll tax on access to justice.
You know, the law is the operating system of our democracy, and you have to pay to see it.
They make about $120 million a year on the PACER system, and it doesn't cost anything near that, according to their own records. In fact, it's illegal. The E-Government Act of 2002 states that the courts may charge only to the extent necessary in order to reimburse the costs of running PACER. Around that time, I ran into Aaron at a conference, and I said, hey, I'm thinking about an intervention on the PACER problem.
Schultz had already developed a program that could automatically download PACER documents from the trial libraries. Schwartz wanted to take a look.
So I showed him the code. And I didn't know what would come next. But as it turns out, over the course of the next few hours at that conference, he was off sitting in a corner, improving my code, recruiting a friend of his that lived near one of these libraries to go into the library and to begin to test his improved code, at which point the folks at the courts realized something's not going quite according to plan.
And data started to come in and come in and come in, and soon there were 760 gigabytes of Pacer docs, about 20 million pages.
Aaron and Carl decided to go talk to the New York Times about what happened.
They also caught the attention of the FBI, who began to stake out Schwartz's parents' house in Illinois. The downloading also uncovered massive privacy violations in the court documents. Ultimately, the courts were forced to change their policies as a result. And the FBI closed their investigation without bringing charges.
To this day, I find it remarkable that anybody, even at the most remote podunk field office of the FBI, thought that a fitting use for taxpayer dollars was investigating people for criminal theft on the grounds that they had made the law public. How can you call yourself a lawman and think that there can possibly be anything wrong in this whole world with making the law public?
Aaron was willing to put himself at risk for the causes that he believed in.
This is a small part of the soundtrack of the 2014 movie, The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz. His death at age 26 in 2013 made the internet light up with grief and also anger at a judicial system that haunted and hunted him. The film runs 1 hour and 45 minutes, and you can find it at www.takepart.com/internets-own-boy. Those who admired Aaron as internet designer will be surprised by the political activist side of him. Here's Aaron's voice.
So I co-founded a group called the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and what we try and do is we try and organize people over the internet who care about progressive politics and moving the country in a more progressive direction to join our email list, join our campaigns, and help get progressive candidates elected all across the country.
The group is responsible for igniting the grassroots effort behind the campaign to elect Elizabeth Warren to the Senate.
He might have thought it was a dumb system, but he came in and he said, I need to learn this system because it can be manipulated like any, you know, like any social system.
But his passion for knowledge in libraries didn't take a back seat. Aaron began to take a closer look at institutions that publish academic journal articles.
By virtue of being students at a major U.S. university, I assume that you have access to a wide variety of scholarly journals. Pretty much every major university in the United States pays these sort of licensing fees to organizations like JSTOR and Thompson and ISI to get access to scholarly journals that the rest of the world can't read.
These scholarly journals and articles are essentially the entire wealth of human knowledge online, and many have been paid for with taxpayer money or with government grants. But to read them, you often have to pay again, handing over steep fees to publishers like Reed Elsevier.
These licensing fees are so substantial that people who are studying in India instead of studying in the United States don't have this kind of access. They're locked out from all of these journals. They're locked out from our entire scientific legacy. I mean, a lot of these journal articles, they go back to the Enlightenment. Every time someone has written down a scientific paper, it's been scanned and digitized and put in these collections. It's a legacy that should belong to us as a commons, as a people, but instead it's been locked up and put online by a handful of for-profit corporations who then try and get the maximum profit they can out of it.
So a researcher paid by the university or the people publishes a paper, and in the very, very last step of that process, after all the work is done, after all the original research is done, the thinking, the lab work, the analysis, after everything is done at that last stage, then the researcher has to hand over his or her copyright to this multi-billion dollar company. And it's sick.
Talk about a scam. One publisher in Britain made a profit of $3 billion last year. I mean, what a racket.
JSTOR is just a very, very small player in that story. But for some reason, JSTOR is the player that Aaron decided to confront.
Working on a fellowship at Harvard, he knew users on MIT's famously open and fast network next door had authorized access to the riches of JSTOR.
Eventually, there was an unlocked supply closet in the basement of one of the buildings. And he went, instead of going through Wi-Fi, he went down there and he just plugged his computer directly into the network and just left it there with an external hard drive downloading these articles to the computer.
Unknown to Swartz, his laptop and hard drive had been found by authorities. They didn't stop the downloads. Instead, they installed a surveillance camera.
And this camera produced the grainy film we all have seen of a young man with backpack and bicycle helmet entering and exchanging hard drives. On his way home, Aaron is arrested and beaten. From here on, the story becomes disturbing. The Aaron Swartz persecution shows the degree of surveillance and criminalization of the internet that affects all users today. He is Elliot Peters, Aaron's defense attorney.
Well, they execute search warrants at Aaron's house, his apartment in Cambridge, and his office at Harvard.
2 days before the arrest, the investigation had gone beyond JSTOR and the local Cambridge police. It had been taken over by the United States Secret Service. The Secret Service began investigating computer and credit card fraud in 1984, but 6 weeks after the attack on 9/11, their role expanded. President Bush used the Patriot Act to establish a network of what they called electronic crimes task forces.
The bill before me takes account of the new realities and dangers posed by modern terrorists.
The Secret Service turned Swartz's case over to the Boston U.S. Attorney's Office.
He wasn't stealing, he wasn't selling what he got or giving it away. He was making a point, as far as I could tell.
The arrest took its toll on Swartz.
He wouldn't give off any sensitive information about his whereabouts during this time because he was so afraid that the FBI would be waiting for him.
It was a time of unprecedented social and political activism. Time magazine would later name as their 2011 Person of the Year, the protester.
WikiLeaks had released a trove of diplomatic cables. Manning had been under arrest at the time. It was unknown whether he was the source of the leak. Anonymous, which is a kind of protest ensemble that has a lot of hackers in its ranks, were going on various sprees of sorts. If you compare that to what he did, his stuff should have been left behind for MIT and JSTOR to deal with in a kind of private, professional manner. It should have never gotten the attention of the criminal system.
Swartz turned down the plea deal. Even with the physical evidence seized from Aaron's Acer computer, hard drive, and USB drive, the prosecutors needed evidence of his motives. Why was Aaron Swartz downloading articles from JSTOR, and just what did he plan to do with them?
The government claims that he was planning to publish these. We don't really know whether that was his real intention, because Aaron also had a history of doing projects where he'd analyze giant data sets of articles in order to learn interesting things about them.
The best evidence for that was that when he was at Stanford, he also downloaded the whole Westlaw legal database.
He uncovered troubling connections between funders of legal research and favorable results.
He did this amazing analysis of for-profit companies giving money to law professors who wrote law review articles, which were then beneficial to, like, Exxon during an oil spill, right? So it was a very corrupt system of funding, you know, vanity research.
Swartz had never released the Westlaw documents.
In theory, he could have been doing the same thing about the JSTOR database. That would have been completely okay.
I don't know what he was going to do with that database, but I heard from a friend of his that Aaron had told him he was going to analyze the data for evidence of corporate funding of climate change research that led to biased results. And I totally believe that.
This is the Guerrilla Open Access Manifesto, supposedly written in July 2008 in Italy. Information is power.
But like all power, there are those who want to keep it for themselves. The world's entire scientific and cultural heritage, published over centuries in books and journals, is increasingly being digitized and locked up by a handful of private corporations. Meanwhile, those who have been locked out are not standing idly by. You've been sneaking through holes and climbing over fences, liberating the information locked up by the publishers and sharing them with your friends. But all this action goes on in the dark, hidden underground. It's called stealing or piracy, as if sharing a wealth of knowledge were the moral equivalent of plundering a ship and murdering its crew. But sharing isn't immoral, it's a moral imperative. Only those blinded by greed would refuse to let a friend make a copy. There's no justice in following unjust laws. It's time to come into the light and, in the grand tradition of civil disobedience, declare our opposition to this private theft of public culture.
On July 14, 2011, federal prosecutors indict Schwartz on four felony counts. The District of Massachusetts United States Attorney's Office released a statement saying Schwartz faces up to 35 years in prison, to be followed by 3 years of supervised release, restitution, forfeiture, and a fine of up to $1 million. He is released on $100,000 bail. The same day, the primary victim in the case, JSTOR, formally drops all charges against Schwartz and declines to pursue the case.
And so it's our belief that with that, the case will be over. That we should be able to get Steve Hyman to drop the case or settle it in some rational way. And the government refused.
Why?
Well, because I think they wanted to make an example out of Aaron. And they said they wanted to use this case as a case of deterrence. They told us that.
They told you that?
Yes.
Deterring who?
It would be easier to understand the Obama administration's posture of supposedly being for deterrence if this was an administration that, for instance, prosecuted arguably the biggest economic crime that this country has seen in the last 100 years, the crimes that were committed that led to the financial crisis on Wall Street.
That was Salon columnist David Sirota, interviewed for the 2014 movie The Internet's Own Boy, in what were to be the last 2 years of his young life, from age 24 to his death at 26. Aaron threw himself into a passionate campaign for internet access. Go to the website for the film to see the frequent interviews on the RT News Channel, as well as a mini documentary on the amazing uphill and surprisingly successful battle against SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act. Aaron and other critics said that SOPA threatened free speech and innovation and enabled law enforcement to block access to entire internet domains in violation of the First Amendment. Here is Aaron Swartz in one of his last interviews.
There's sort of these two polarizing perspectives, right? Everything is great. The internet has created all this freedom and liberty and everything's going to be fantastic. Or everything is terrible. The internet has created all these tools for cracking down and spying and, you know, controlling what we say. And I think both are true, right? And which one will win out in the long run is up to us.
On September 12, 2012, federal prosecutors filed a superseding indictment against Schwartz, adding additional counts of wire fraud, unauthorized access to a computer, and computer fraud. Now, instead of four felony counts, Schwartz was facing 13. The prosecution's leverage had dramatically increased, as did Schwartz's potential jail time and fines. Much of the prosecution's case against Schwartz involved a law created originally in 1986. It is called the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. We all know what terms of use are. Most people don't read them, but not abiding by their terms could mean you are committing a felony.
The website terms of service often say things like be nice to each other or don't do anything that's improper. The idea that the criminal law has anything to say about these kinds of violations, I think, strikes most people as crazy.
The examples get even more crazy. Until it was changed in March of 2013, the terms of use on the website of Hearst's 17 magazine said you had to be 18 in order to read it.
I would say that the way the CFA has been interpreted by the Justice Department, we are probably all breaking the law.
11 of the 13 charges against Schwartz involved the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act.
So the selective enforcement of a law that we all have broken was part of what was used to haunt Aaron Swartz into his death. Swartz declined a plea bargain 2 days after the prosecution rejected a counteroffer by Swartz's lawyer. He was found dead in his Brooklyn, New York apartment. The film, The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz, has a moving postscript by Cory Doctorow, the Canadian journalist and science fiction writer.
So there was a kid back in February from Baltimore, 14 years old, who had access to JSTOR. And he figured out a way to do early tests for pancreatic cancer. And pancreatic cancer kills the shit out of you because we detect it way too late. And he sent emails off to the entire oncology department at Johns Hopkins, and most of them ignored it, right? But one of them, like, sent him an email back and said, this is not an entirely stupid idea. Why don't you come on over? And this kid worked evenings and weekends with this researcher. And in February, I heard him on the news, just a couple of weeks after Aaron died, when Aaron was in the news a lot. And he said they were shipping an early test for pancreatic cancer that was going to save lives. And he said, this is why what Aaron did was so important. It's where the thing that's going to keep your kid from dying of pancreatic cancer comes from. And without access, the person who might come up with a thing that's got your number on it may never find that answer.
Cory Doctorow and his tribute to Aaron Swartz, the prodigy whose contributions to the internet come up every time you open your computer. Aaron dedicated his life, and maybe even his death, to open access and the commons of wisdom and information that we can enjoy through an open internet or lose to corporate and government control. The voices you heard are all from the new film by Brian Knappenberger, The Internet's Own Boy, the story of Aaron Swartz, released in June 2014. The website is www.takepart.com/internets-own-boy. When you see the 1-hour, 45-minute film, you'll be able to put faces to the voices in this radio program. They include Aaron's brothers, Noah and Ben, his mother and his father, Gabriella Coleman, Lawrence Lessig, Tim Berners-Lee, attorney Elliot Peters, and many more. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Open the newest programs page and scroll down. TUC Radio's free to all radio stations, and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.